Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Front pages first. Look, there is a lot of news on the front pages and we will come to that, but there are, on most of the front pages, there are four young women. And I think, I know we're past the days of moral victories and glorious defeats and everything in Ireland, but I think there that we all agree that there was something extraordinary about last night, and something different about it, and something amazing about it for the whole country, and that there was a win there for sure. So Sophie Becker, Phil Healy, Rashida Adeleke and Charlene Maudsley, there they are on the front of the Sunday Independent. The Sunday Independent leading with T-shirt goes to war against online hatred. He's to host a major online safety summit. The Sunday Times, and there are the 4x400 metres relay team again, but their lead story is crisis as 1,000 teaching posts remain vacant. The Irish Mail on Sunday, far right threat to hijack Aviva England clash, all Garda leave cancelled for game over UK riot gang fears. The Mirror, 99% of asylum refusals still in Ireland. So 31 of 2,758 asylum seekers refused status by the Department of Justice over 5 years were sent back to their country of entry, and that's by Ken Fox. The Business Post exclusive, Ireland, Coke and Uncle Sam. So Coca-Cola's Irish office, which is a modest little office in a kind of a strip mall somewhere, has been accused of hiding astronomical profits by US tax authorities. They funneled more than 9.5 billion to a remote tax haven since 2016, the Business Post can reveal. And this was not just Ireland, I think Coca-Cola were doing this from other centres around the world as well. And the Sun on Sunday, Fianna Fáil Grá for Gráinne. So they're saying Fianna Fáil bosses want TV star Gráinne Shorga to run for the party in the upcoming general election. Right, our panel this morning, Lucinda Creighton is the CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former Minister for European Affairs. Harry McGee is political correspondent with the Irish Times. Sinead McSweeney is the former global head of public policy at Twitter and a psychology student at Trinity College Dublin. And Oisín Coughlin is the chief executive of Friends of the Earth Ireland. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Brendan. Morning.
Did everybody watch the race last night, Oisín?
Yes, extraordinary stuff. I mean, and you end up feeling disappointed when, I mean, as you say, we have kind of no right to feel disappointed. Coming fourth in the world is extraordinary. You just felt they deserved to get a medal after all of that effort. It was remarkable.
Yeah. Sinead, you saw Rashida running during the week, did you?
Yeah, last Monday. We were lucky enough, there was, you know, the late releases of tickets. A good friend of ours was getting the notifications for that, so he saw that there were tickets for the heats. So we took a last minute decision to head to Paris for 2 days, and we saw her race, and Charlene and Sophie Becker as well. And for pure fluke, we actually, our seats were on the finish line. So I felt like a bit of a fraud. I was reminded of the 1984 Olympics where we had a neighbour who stayed up every night, because obviously with the time difference for LA, stayed up every single night. My dad didn't, but he decided the night of the marathon to stay up, and the neighbour went to bed, and he was furious the following morning. Yeah. So I felt a little bit like that. But
the
atmosphere, it was a fabulous
in the Stade de France seems extraordinary, is it?
It yeah. was incredible. I mean, it sounds almost kind of trite and wholesome, but you literally just had this sense of the nations of the world coming together, and people were talking to each other, who were you supporting, people explaining the significance of their flags. But it wasn't just the Stade de France, it was the whole city. Like, the whole city was at the Olympics, and particularly the number, I think the way Paris did it, with the number of free events like the Park of Champions, going to see the flame, the Eiffel Tower area. It was all very manageable, actually, because I was a bit stressed before and anxious before I went, but I found it very manageable.
You were there for a few days as well, Lisa?
Yeah, a bit like that. I wasn't at the Athletics. I was at the show jumping in Versailles and got tickets again through a friend last minute, and just decided to go with my daughter, who's 10, who's a keen show jumper. And it was phenomenal. So we spent the day in Versailles at the show jumping, at the individual final, where Ireland should have won a medal, but unfortunately just didn't come together at the very last occasion. And then we spent the following day in Paris, and as Sinead said, the whole city was just alive with the Olympics. But it was really manageable. Everything was just so well done, in terms of traffic management, and it was just a fantastic atmosphere. Yeah. It was amazing, really amazing.
I think people kind of semi-hoping, is this a reset for France in a way? But Harry, was last night a reset for Ireland in a way?
It was, I think. It's a little bit like how many people were in the GPO for the 1960 rising. I can confirm that I wasn't there. I looked at the race last night in Leybay, between Tulsk and Strokes down in County Roscommon on my way back from Mayo, but it was absorbing. And I felt so sorry for Charlene Maudsley. It was her birthday yesterday. She was 26 years of age. They had little raspberries and a candle for her in the morning. And she ran an amazing leg. She was almost as quick as Rosita Adeleke in her leg, but she was still pipped for the post. And she was distraught afterwards. And I really, really felt for her. They smashed the Irish record by, I think, almost 3 seconds in an amazing race. And before the race, Greg Allen was saying that a sixth place finish for them would be very, very respectable indeed. So they outperformed all expectations in relation to them, and we were so proud of them. And there were such gorgeous people as well, and fantastic role models for young kids, especially girls who want to become interested in sports and athletics.
Yeah, and I'm hoping they're in a car on their way to a studio in Paris as we speak, so we hopefully speak to them at some stage in the next hour or so. On what Harry was saying there about role models to young people and all that, there's a lot across the papers today about what we do to support sports and athletes and stuff in this country. So, Lucinda, you picked this piece in the Sunday Times: Olympic success in Paris, but outdated facilities at home.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the starting point is that things have improved, and I think we have to acknowledge that. And this is our best Olympics ever, we certainly were in contention for more medals in a lot of sports, and we're unlucky in some. I think we have begun the process of professionalising and really taking seriously, all sports, Olympic sports, and really trying to be competitive for medals. And, participation is great and all the rest of it, but of course you want to win medals at the end of the day.
I think medals brings participation as well, doesn't
undoubtedly,
it?
Like undoubtedly.
It's the last leader to get all kids involved.
100%. And we've seen that with the likes of, rowing and boxing and across other sports as well. And in some sports, we are amongst the best in the world. And I mentioned we were at the show jumping. Ireland was the number one team in the world going into that. So it's really unlucky that we did not win either a team or individual medal at Paris. And, LA, I think, we're coming for you. I think it's about investment, of course, about improving facilities, but also showcasing those role models, and platforming them and giving them opportunities to speak to those young athletes in whatever discipline, so that they get to see and understand that it is possible. And I think we can definitely take a leaf out of what has happened in the UK. They set their sights on the London Olympics. They invested massively. They had targeted particular sports, but they invested massively across the board, and they reaped the reward in London, and they have continued to reap the reward since then. Back to my passion for equestrian sport, but if you look at Japan, for example, in eventing, which is the three discipline equestrian sport, Japan was eliminated in Tokyo and they won a bronze medal in Paris 3 years later. And they have invested, they made it a priority, they've invested heavily, and it has really paid off. And that team is now, that they are role models for young Japanese athletes. And I think that's has to be the approach, that you really focus on what's achievable and invest and encourage and showcase the successes that we've had.
And Harry, I think we did ramp up the investment for this cycle, didn't we? But as someone, you picked that piece as well, as someone who's involved in grassroots level sport here, what's your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, funding for sports has increased substantially over the past 10 years, and it's a win in every single imaginable metric, in terms of community gain, in terms of health, in terms of fitness, in terms of keeping people away from the kind of health problems that, that they encounter in the States and otherwise. And it's a win on all situations.
Does
and
the GAA suck up too much of our energy and focus and money in this country?
That's a loaded question. I think all sports could do with more funding, including the GAA.
Such a politician's answer.
Including
get a lot, but the GAA is the biggest participatory sport. And I think perhaps GAA gets a lot of money because it's very well organised and it has been very focused and it has been very politically astute over the years in terms of identifying where it needs investment and how it needs investment.
And as someone who coaches underage, is there any lessons to be learned from the GAA in terms of how we organise other sports or how we push their imprint?
Well, I mean, the big thing in GAA in the past decade in particular has been inclusion. And the big overriding concept in the GAA is that you try to keep people playing for as long as possible. And in some other sports, what happens is that there's exclusion, that as people who are good are focused on rather than those rather than others that struggle. Now, it's a balance. I mean, you have to kind of focus on your elite athletes as well. But the key to what the GAA has been doing over the past decade is trying to be as inclusive as possible, bringing everybody in, trying to keep them playing sports for as long as possible. And that kind of approach is a very good one that could be learned by other sports. One of the interesting things in the Sunday Times article today was about the lack of investment for other sports. And there is a lack of investment. Lucinda was talking about the London Olympics. And what the UK authorities did in sport was they focused on track cycling, because that was something that if somebody was a physically superb specimen, they didn't need the kind of skill levels that you'd need, for example, for equestrian or for some other very, very sports. So they got people to pivot over to track cycling. They built velodromes all over the UK and they reaped the reward in London, and they've reaped the rewards ever since.
And I think we are building one here now with a dozen badminton courts in the middle of it as well.
That's going to be a focus. And we look at, for example, Rhys McClenaghan and his amazing gold in gymnastics. I mean, winning a medal in gymnastics would have been unimaginable a decade ago. But the facilities and the structures have been put in.
Did you see that they went to, I guess, his home club in Newton Ayres, wasn't it?
Yes.
Did you see all the kids in the background, like kids casually doing like cartwheels and all this equipment everywhere and everything? It looked as vibrant as any GAA club in any town in the country.
It is, to use the Twitter analogy, it becomes viral. I mean, success breeds success.
But gymnastics, and we've seen that I think gymnastics has been going for a while. My son did gymnastics for 10 years, and there was a lot of participation of boys and girls, particularly at the younger age.
Yeah.
Of course, it's so good for it's just good for your physical.
Is there a point at which he dropped off then?
Yeah, it's kind of early mid-teens. And he'd got quite good, not quite elite competitive level, but he was doing 10, 12 hours a week. And it's just hard to sustain. And if you aren't actually into the competition part, and it's such a hard sport to compete in, it begins to lose value. But he loved the camaraderie of it. And I see Rhys McClenaghan say during the week he intends to visit every gymnastics club in the country to just as you said, to spread that to spread that message.
I think that is so key, just that children can see and almost feel that sort of those are role models.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the role models for girls, Harry, which the four women last night were. But I think there's an even greater need these days for role models for teenage boys. Maybe I say that as a father of a teenage boy, but there's so little positive role models out there, and there's so many toxic online influences that
you're nodding along with that, Sinead.
Yeah, also, I'm mother of a teenage boy as well, and look at him and all his friends. And I think, whether we're talking about participation in sport, or we're talking about susceptibility to misinformation, or being pulled into any other far right organisations or anything like that. I mean, we need to look at that demand side, that there's something missing in people's lives, and that's what's making all of these avenues attractive. And let's make the positive avenues attractive rather than the negative.
One observation, just speaking about Gaelic football, Gaelic games. I mean,
it is
hugely successful, obviously, across the country, urban, rural, etc. One of the things they do really well are the cool camps, which are, I assume they're subsidised, because like having sent three kids to camps all over the summer. The cost of camps is so expensive, and the Gaelic, the GAA camps are a lot cheaper, much more accessible. And I think that that plays a part as well. It's a kind of a gateway into clubs and into more active participation. And I think that should be considered as well in terms of where money is invested.
Okay. One thing in the funding guide says there won't be extra money overall, and we need to look at taking money from the six sports that are making money, like rugby and horse racing, and giving it to sports that like athletics and swimming that may make better use of it.
Yeah, okay. Another side of sport then, Harry. The Irish Mail on Sunday, far-right threat to hijack Aviva England clash.
Yeah, that's a story by Debbie McCann saying that...
And John Lee, I think, yeah.
Yeah, that there's a possible plot to sabotage the game between Ireland and England in the Aviva stadium, and they're quoting security sources and also political sources in relation to that. You know, I mean, that is conceivable. It would be a perfect place for right-wing agitators who are intent on making trouble to get as much publicity as possible. And according to their quotes, the Gardaí and security authorities are taking the threat as a credible threat at the moment.
Yeah, and it would seem to fit into the kind of background noise that we're seeing at the moment. I was talking to your colleague Conor Gallagher about this yesterday, about that there does seem to be a kind of a seamless robe now of far-right agitation going on between UK, Northern Ireland and the Republic as well.
One of the things that's interesting about that is if you look, for example, in France, places that were kind of former communist strongholds in France now are all voting for Marine Le Pen. So you're talking really not about political ideology, you're talking about populations, people who are poor, who are disenfranchised, and where messages of visceral messages seem to have more purchase and traction with them. And you've seen it happening here, where people who formerly supported Sinn Féin have now deserted the party and are voting for various right-wing parties and right-wing actors. And it's very concerning. And you see that kind of circle going fully around when you saw that extraordinary scene in Belfast last week, where you saw kind of loyalists and people from Coolock brandishing Union Jacks and tricolours walking down in a protest and being involved in trouble there. And it's very, very disturbing, and it's something that's going to be very difficult to deal with, both here and in other countries as well.
Yeah, we don't know that they were from Coolock, by the way. But OK, so where the conversation is at the moment, and there's a lot in the papers today about it, is the part that online and social media is playing in all of this. So say, Lucinda, we start with the front of the Sunday Independent, Taoiseach goes to war against online hatred.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting one. So obviously, the Taoiseach during the week indicated, you know, that there might be additional or new legislation coming down the tracks. Obviously, there's been a lot of focus on this hate speech legislation. I've always contended that actually we have a huge amount of legislation, and we also now have EU legislation, the Digital Services Act, which is really robust, actually, and allows for the imposition of really huge fines on social media companies that are facilitating or harbouring or not dealing with incitement to hatred or whatever.
I'm sorry, just to be clear here, is what the Taoiseach is talking about not just the implementation
Ireland? So the article today, the letter that he has circulated to government departments actually is very much now focused on implementation, which I think is the correct approach, because there's a huge amount of legislation, and actually what we need to see is implementation. We need resourcing. For the Gardaí, this is a new, modern threat, which, is beginning to be understood by cybercrime experts and others in police forces and law enforcement.
Beginning to be understood?
Yeah.
This conversation was going on 10 years ago, as far as I can remember. And this stuff about they should be treated as publishers. How long have the people in the media been saying that? And now we're saying it all as if it's news.
Still isn't in this legislation, the publisher question.
No, because there's huge resistance to it. Sorry, Lucinda, you finish and then I want to go to Sinead.
So under the Digital Services Act, there are enormous powers now available to national authorities to enforce standards online. And incitement to hatred is already a criminal offence in Ireland on statute books since the late 1980s. So there's plenty that the Gardaí can do with the right resources and the right capabilities. And that requires training, investment and manpower. And I think we're, okay. You know...
So the framework is there, is what you're saying.
Yeah,
and it's
absolutely.
Good that there's
absolutely.
A sense of urgency about maybe doing
and
it.
And we also have... So, we also have the terrorist content online regulation, which was introduced by Julian King, the very last UK commissioner, and it's a really robust piece of regulation which applies in Ireland as it does in every other EU member state, and it imposes obligations to immediately within a very short period of time take down content that is leading to or encouraging terrorist activity.
I think one of the things that it seems to have particularly annoyed the Taoiseach this week, and he hasn't spoken about it in terms of his own experience of that bomb threat against him being left up on, I think, Instagram. For 3 days or something. But Sinead, I'd be interested in your perspective on this as the former global head of public policy at Twitter. The piece you've picked is John Mooney in the Sunday Times, Taoiseach's tough task to tackle social media hate. Because with all the legislation in the world, it feels like it's kind of unmanageable too, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it's important not to be fatalistic about it either. I think the problem is more complicated than a lot even of the columnists across the various papers would paint it. I picked John Mooney's article because I think he's more realistic about the complexity of the challenge, but he also lays out categorically the fact that there are now an awful lot of structures in place. It's a question of resourcing them. It's a question of ensuring that, you know, the Digital Services Act, our own domestic legislation, etc., is effectively implemented. But I think the main challenge that we're like, The bomb threat post, like, that just seems bizarre to me that would have been left up for that length of time. That's I'd be going for kind of there must be some like human error or something there. That because the big challenge,
Can I just interrupt you and say, is there not all kinds of poisonous, awful stuff left sitting up there and daily a waterfall of it coming at everybody?
Yeah, absolutely.
And there seems to be no... The companies do seem to put up their hands and say, we can't really control this. Like,
well, I think that one of the challenges is that a lot of commentators and a lot of analysis conflates illegal content and harmful content. Mm-hmm. And this... And funny, this is why we're 10 years waiting for legislation, because governments didn't want to touch that either. And self-regulation suited governments for a long time, because the tricky decisions about where free speech ends and where harmful or, you know, challenging content started was a decision they didn't want to make. So they were happy to leave it to the companies.
Self-regulation by the companies, probably not entirely successful when we look back to have left it this long now, was it?
Exactly. But I mean, I remember sitting in rooms and saying, yeah, go on, please do legislate, because these decisions shouldn't be left in the hands of private companies. And I suppose at that stage, I was, you know, everybody thinks their own house is better than everybody else's houses, yeah. Right? And then looking back, you know, I knew, you know, my job was torn between defending very often the indefensible externally, but then lobbying and advocating internally for things that just had to change. But
so I'm not going to make you responsible for all the crimes of social media. Can I ask you one other question, mm-hmm. though? You see, I think the way some people would see it is that if you build a vast money-making machine, but you don't really kind of, like, if a newspaper, they used to be vast money-making machines, but there were huge costs associated with them as well, because there were layers of lawyers and sub-editors and all kinds of stuff. And I'm probably talking about the good old days there. You build a vast money-making machine and then you go, so look, yeah, we can't really control that. Sorry, will somebody regulate us, please, and help us? Is that a bogus kind of argument?
And you know, people make cars and have them regulated as well. I mean, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, firstly, I mean, there are the same costs that you talk about for newspapers associated with the building of, I mean, Twitter was never a vast money-making machine. Mark Zuckerberg would have boasted that they spent more on all of those safety structures that you're talking about than we would have had turnover in a year. But the challenge is that, you know, you can kind of say this is there isn't a parallel between social media and publishing. So,
okay.
you know, in some ways, we need to start and continue to start to think outside the box instead of trying to find the old solutions and make them sit and fit social media. We have to look at what social media is and, more importantly, look at what AI is now and actually think more radically about how we're going to...
And can you see any kind of radical answers or paradigm we can put in it or anything?
Again, in the kind of spirit of not being fatalistic about it, I mean, I think we have, like, my own thinking about this has evolved a lot, I guess, in the 2 years since I left that world. And I'm kind of more realistic about the challenges and about a lot of the dangers. But I also see the huge positives that it's too much to lose. I mean, we've seen that because we've lost Twitter. And so we lost a utility. We always had an argument that some of these platforms, and particularly the big open platforms like Twitter, should have been like almost like public utilities. They should never have been money making ventures. But I think that it's easy to say, oh, we must regulate the companies or have, you know, director liability and all of that. That's not actually solving the problems that are at the core of what's going on here in our societies, in our democracies, in our local communities. It's an accelerant, undoubtedly.
The scale of it is huge,
but the underlying problems are something different.
Well, and to be a little bit fatalistic about it, sometimes it feels like King Canute trying to say, tell the waves to stop, because they're not like newspapers, because newspapers are circumscribed to a certain extent. You can actually feel the limits of newspapers, where social media sometimes seems to be this boundless universe. Lucinda was talking about the Digital Service Act, and that's not really a panacea for all ills. It's an improvement, but it's still a hybrid. For example, you're talking about Simon Harris complaining about it taking 3 days to take that post down. And Commissioner Mion, which is the body in Ireland which is implementing the Digital Service Act, says that it does not have powers to compel the immediate removal of illegal content from online platforms. Our role is to make sure that the platform's content reporting systems are working effectively in compliance with the law. And that's a very important distinction. In relation to X, formerly Twitter, I think one of the most salient quotes in this morning's piece in the Sunday Independent was from the Taoiseach to Micheál Martin, when he's referred to Elon Musk. He said, I think Elon Musk and X is problematic. They have a totally different approach. And that totally different approach means regulation is not going to work with the likes of Elon Musk and X as it's currently constituted.
Oisín, to what Sinead says there, and like we can't forget it at times like this. A, there is huge benefits from social media. Twitter was a fantastic thing for so many people, for such and I think some people still do use it for good and everything. And secondly, that what this is doing is accelerating stuff that's there already.
I mean, yes, it's an accelerant, but I think we're missing one bit still. It's not just an accelerant. I mean, if you look at the actual business model and the algorithms that are used to drive it, they are amplifying the most divisive, the most toxic content. That seems to be all the evidence we're seeing, whether or not you have...
Is that correct, Sinead, that this argument about that engagement is what drives the algorithm and people are more likely to engage with nasty stuff, sensational stuff?
I mean, there's no simple answer to that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's layers to it, and all of the platforms are different. So yes, I mean, you are looking for engagement, but it's human nature that leads us to engage with negative content. So,
at the very least, it's a vicious circle that is being monetized for massive profit and at huge expense of the public. I mean, there was a study
again. Not, again, though, we should say, as Sinead has pointed out, not by Twitter, really. No. Never a huge moneymaker. And Musk now seems to be happy to lose whatever
money. And maybe you're right. Maybe we should have nationalised, internationalised Twitter so that we could have had the public forum that we enjoyed five or 10 years ago. But like there's research showing that, you know, within 15 minutes of creating a teenage boy, to go back to teenage boys, account on YouTube, you get fed Andrew Tate stuff because it's assumed by the algorithm that that's what will engage you. And that is, you know, child abuse. You could argue that it is not doing our kids any good. And I'm not sure what pit of the pipe we regulate, but like all of this structure we've just been talking about seems like it's the end of pipe rather than the underlying industry.
I think you've mentioned something.
Sinead, come in there for a second.
We'll come back to you. Stop trying to regulate the pipe. But we have to start looking at the demand side. You know, the pipe is there. It has to be regulated. It has to be effective regulation. But we also have to look at what that water is falling on. What is it about the ground that it's falling on that is making it susceptible to the Andrew Tates, to the Donald Trumps, to the far right, or to misinformation.
Yeah, so it's one part of the problem, is what you're saying, and I think that is a fair point.
If you use the drug analysis, as in the illegal drugs, you don't criminalize the users in the best practice too much. You focus on the kingpins who are making money. So yes, we can, you know, parents have an obvious duty of oversight on their children's social media use. Not all of whom are doing that, but we can't leave it only to parents on their own who are struggling.
It's about society. It's about investment in society. It's not just about parents. It's about how our education system works, how we're helping children to learn how to think, how to analyse, how to argument, how to disagree, that we need to move away from binary thinking about a range of issues, because that's what's feeding the sense of you either belong or you don't belong. You have to belong to something, so you're going to belong over here. Like, there's a huge groundswell work that is far more complicated than saying I'm going to declare war on Elon Musk or social media.
Okay, Lucinda, you want to come in there? Just before you do, can I just tell you that Gardaí investigating online threats against an elected representative have arrested a male in his 40s this morning. He's currently detained under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act at a Garda station in the Garda Northwestern region. You wanted to come in.
Well, I mean, that's positive, isn't it? Because I think there's another question around... you know, public representation, and, you know, whether it's appropriate to try to protect those who put their name on ballot papers and those who serve in our national parliament and government, etc. And I feel very strongly that we have a responsibility and a duty, and that there should be no apologies about ensuring that we have proper security and proper intelligence capabilities when it comes to protecting elected representatives. But it's not quite the point, but it's certainly an element of it. I think Oisín makes an important point about algorithmic amplification, and it's something that the EU regulation doesn't really address at the moment, which I think is actually quite simple. I mean, you know, what should be demanded of social media companies is transparency around that, and how these algorithms actually work, and forcing them to actually publish the data and the detail. And if you look at, I've spent like the last eight or so years working specifically on terrorist content online, and I would have engaged a lot with Twitter and Facebook and others. YouTube is a huge offender. Facebook is a huge offender. And if you look at how, say, for example, the Christchurch attacks, or, you know, certain Islamist attacks like the Manchester Arena bombing, etc., how those went viral so quickly, and literally within minutes, hundreds of thousands of views of the Christchurch attacks, for example, and, you know, and essentially, you know, a lack of any analysis or transparency as to how that happened. And the social media companies at the time would have said, oh, well, we took it down. Well, they didn't actually, because they allowed it to pop up on multiple other sites and pages.
It sounded like kind of whack-a-mole.
It's whack-a-mole. It's whack-a-mole, exactly.
It does remind me back to Sinead's point, like, that there were people looking for it. There were people seeking it out as well. And that is another side of it.
Inevitably.
So Sinead, can I ask you, could you give me a brief answer on, would transparency around algorithms and a bit more, a bit more kind of focus on them and public focus on them, would that help the matter?
It might help, but it won't happen. I mean, that's like asking Coke for the recipe for Coke. It's commercially sensitive. Okay. They're not going to. But more worrying, and this is, I suppose, where I would tend to get a bit more fatalistic about tech, is that we're at a point where some of the companies no longer know how their algorithm works.
Algorithms.
And you say it's not going to happen, but I mean, you can nationalize railways. You can also, I'm not saying we should nationalize Facebook, but you know, the countries can decide to regulate.
But Roisin, listen to what Sinead is saying. Sinead is saying that the people themselves do no longer understand how this technology that is absolutely contributing to destroying the world, we are at the point where they no longer understand.
Sure, but she's also saying they've refused to publish what they do know because it's commercially, they view it as commercially sensitive. You can regulate that.
Just a point on that. I mean, on commercially sensitive information, there's no reason why law enforcement agencies and intelligence and security agencies across Europe can't have access to that data. It doesn't have to be publicly available, but it absolutely can.
And regulators even behind the scenes.
Okay, absolutely. Before we leave it, Sinead, I know your time at Twitter ended shortly after Elon Musk took over. Did you ever meet him or did you form any sense of him?
I did. I had an hour-long meeting with him in the first few days. I did form a sense of him, and I'm now doing a psychology degree to see if I can make sense of that sense that I formed of him. I was intrigued. Declan Lynch's piece today on him is quite interesting, where he talks about the rich kid energy and the lust for chaos. I'm not sure he has a lust for chaos. I mean, one of the things that struck me, I mean, I found he was very personable, very engaging. As I say, we chatted for an hour. I wasn't a fan of the acquisition, and I came off that conversation with a kind of a hope that actually things would work out, which was something I hadn't had before that. But within days, the situation was very different. It strikes me that it's like there's a disconnect sometimes between what he says and the possible consequences.
Is it a game to him sometimes?
I did at one time express the view after the acquisition that we had just become a billionaire's plaything, which I think is probably what happened. I mean, Scott Galloway, actually, he's a US professor, is very interesting on this, not just about Musk, but I think about the tech billionaire bros collectively, that kind of, you know, religion fell away, different things fell away. And so we still have this human quest for super beings. And we kind of allocated that standing to, you know, Steve Jobs, to Mark Zuckerberg, to Elon Musk. But, you know, he talks about the fact that, we attribute to Musk in particular that he's always playing chess, where sometimes he's just playing checkers. And, you know, in some ways, I think, you know, we're almost giving him too much attention at the moment.
And actually, it's interesting what Galloway says. These are guys who were good at one thing. Some of them just got really lucky. We're in the right place at the right time. And yet, but like, the reality is, yes, we give them a lot of attention, but the reality is also they have huge power.
They do have huge power. But I do think, like, if you, I compare it a little bit to Trump. People talk about, Twitter's role, as we call it, in the election of Trump. But the reality was that, like, the population of the US is 350 million. At that time, Twitter had 330 million users, 80% of whom were outside of the US. So the people in the US who were seeing Donald Trump's tweets were not seeing them on Twitter.
They were seeing them on mainstream
but
media.
The best phrase
slavishly
I heard about Twitter's role was an assignment editor for journalists in the US at the time, and indeed around the world. Journalists followed what was happening on Twitter, which is why, like, NGOs and lobbyists like ourselves felt we had to be there too. Yeah. That, I think, has broken. Journalists no longer, I think they've no longer see Twitter as the place to get stories in the same way, which is one small element of hope.
Okay, that was really interesting. Okay, but I need to take a break. Lucinda Creighton, Harry McGee, Sinead McSweeney and Oisin Coughlan staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Lucinda Creighton, Harry McGee, Sinead McSweeney and Oisin Coughlan are still with us, and having sorted the problems of the online world, we will tend to our own garden now. Harry, the Irish Mail on Sunday, coalition split on whether budget should favour children or pensioners. John Lee is writing this.
Yeah, this is a headline and a story that you're going to see countless times between now and the budget.
Almost
as often as Donald Trump's Twitter account. John Lee has a story saying that a row is brewing between the main coalition parties in relation to the cost of living package. So you have the budget, capital spending, current spending, and for the past couple of years we've had this separate cost of living package. part of which has been funded by the corporation tax windfall, manna from heaven, the money tree, etc. We thought that it might be coming to an end this year because of the precipitous fall in inflation.
It's gone. It's only getting worse slash better.
Well, it went from 10% to 2%. We can see the petrol and diesel prices have come down compared to what they were 2 or 3 years ago, even though the subvention that the government gave for the past two years has been removed. But the Taoiseach, Tánaiste, and the Divil and all within Cabinet promised that we'd have a cost of living package in the budget. We don't know the amount of it. John Lee is speculating this morning it's going to be 2.3 billion. But he said there's a kind of an ideological divide within Cabinet between those who wanted to be spent on the youngest cohort, children in society, and those who wanted to be spent on the older cohort.
Would you believe that? Would that make sense?
I think there'd be a bit of a split. Yeah, there'd be a split between parties in relation to where the money. I think Fianna Fáil traditionally would Fianna Fáil would probably gear towards increasing pensions more. But pensions won't form part of this cost of living package because it'll be once off and it won't be recurring. That will form part of the main budget. But you might get kind of lump sums for fuel allowance, for living alone, carers allowance, etc., as we've seen in the past couple of years. And then the other side of the coin is in relation to children. What happened last year in the cost of living package was that there was a once-off doubling of payment on children's benefit for all families. It's a universal
which
payment.
The minister keeps saying proved very popular, as if it wouldn't.
Well, it's a late show. There's one for everybody in the audience, you know, and that's always going to be popular. So I think Fine Gael in particular are pushing for that. So they're the kind of debates in relation to detail, in relation to kind of jockeying for position that we're going to see in the run-up to October.
Well, and if it's anything like the last few years, they'll end up doing it all. Anyway, they won't make any hard choices on it. Sinead, you picked that story in conjunction with another story in the Mail on Sunday about a huge regional divide in waiting lists for carers.
Yeah. I mean, I think it struck me again, we're back to this sense of kind of it's trying to split everything into a binary thing. You know, it's you know, and pitting young against old, you know, this kind of competitiveness, whereas actually within all of those categories there are massive inequalities and inequities, and that's why the other Mail article about carers waiting lists where it shows that half of the people on the national waiting list are actually situated in 6.5 counties in the south. And I mean, I think I'm on the board of the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, and again we would see this similar issue of inequality and inequity of access to services that are really great in some areas and then just not available in others.
Yeah, and it's the same with CAMHS. It seems to be the same with services for kids with disabilities and everything. Lucinda, you picked a piece in the Business Post by Daniel Murray. Extraordinary off-book spending hikes will be lasting legacy of this government. So the Business Post has been pushing this story for the last few weeks, that there is a kind of a chicanery going on here about what's included this year and next year, and that
there's no doubt about it. Temporary becomes core and this and that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, we've sort of, because everybody wants to put behind us the sort of Celtic Tiger, you know, bonanza spending, the irresponsible management of exchequer spending, etc. So nobody in government obviously wants to in any way admit that there has been a bonanza in spending. But in Daniel's piece, he's saying government spending has surged by a whopping 47% in the last 5 years, from 71.3 billion in budget 2020 to 105.4 billion planned in budget 2025, an increase of 32 billion. I mean, it's off the chart. So, I mean, anybody in government who seriously tries to suggest that there has been fiscal rectitude practiced by this government, I mean, you know, they can't do it with a straight face.
They will say we're saving a lot of money and that this is to do with growing population.
But meanwhile, we have the IFAC, the Fiscal Advisory Council, which was established, let's remember, in the aftermath of Ireland going into an IMF bailout programme after the country was bankrupt after years of similar style profligate spending. spending. The IFAC has repeatedly, as is the governor of the central bank, don't forget in his recent letter, warned the government that, you know, our over-reliance, we all know this, but our over-reliance on corporate tax receipts is not sustainable. The tax base is too narrow, and effectively our public finances are precarious. So yes, you know, the economy is booming. Yes, we have full employment. Yes, we have all of these good things. And I would be the first to say, you know, there are many, many, as Brian Cowan would have said back in the day, the fundamentals in a sense are good. But, you know, part of it is built on sand. And this level of spending increase is not sustainable. It's not responsible. It is dangerous. And I'm glad that my stable, the Business Post, is highlighting this week in, week out. And it's also the editorial, in addition to Daniel Murray's piece, Danny McConnell, the editor, has it as his editorial. Okay. And I think, you know, we cannot. OK, great. Everybody's happy to have, you know, more spending on pensions and everything else. But like, we've completely lost all focus on reform. There is no discussion of reform across public service delivery any longer. And, you know, yet we have these inequities and inequalities.
I know health isn't a great example, but it sounds like the Minister for Health and the head of the HSE are actually trying to look under the bonnet and say what's going on here.
I mean, the HSE spending,
I mean, while we keep throwing
health,
more
health
money
spending
at it. Like,
is persistently, wildly over budget every single year.
You know what? Ill health, sickness, accidents are probably wildly over budget as well, though, in fairness.
But this is all predictable. I mean, our demographic growth, everything is predictable. So, I mean, the inability to actually budget and plan for demographic change is inexcusable, actually. To say that reform is happening, I think, is...
They have now created a situation whereby they are looking at more or less time and motion on, like, how many patients are being seen in certain situations.
The hospitals are getting more for productivity, not for waiting lists.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there does appear to have been, like, he hasn't been out on the radio talking about it very much, Stephen Donnelly, but there does appear to have been some reform there. Whether it'll work, I mean, it is a different question. But just one other thing from the John Lee article. I see a Fine Gael source saying they would oppose any increase in the basic social welfare rate because of full employment. But again, judging from what I've heard from the likes of the Vincent de Paul, that's the rate that would make the biggest difference to people actually living in poverty, that the one-off measures are, you can't count on them, you don't know if they're going to come this year. Whereas actually, if you're living in poverty and wanting to try to budget, knowing the social welfare rate would actually keep track with inflation, which it hasn't done, would make the biggest difference.
Okay. Will we talk about America for a minute? Who picked what here on America? I have a kind of a names next to various things here.
There's a poll, a new New York Times Siena poll, you know, one of the most reputable polls in the US, showing Harris has gone to a four point lead in three swing states.
In Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.
Yes, which are the three north Midwestern states that are Democrats must win to carry the election.
Sugar Rush?
It seems to be more, well, we can't tell for sure, because I mean, the last month in US politics has been like nothing in our lifetimes in terms of how much has changed, from the assassination attempt to Biden dropping out to the Kamala phenomenon, and now the vice presidential pick. It does appear to be, it's certainly outside the margin of error, the general shift. She's gone into a lead in the tracking polls or the aggregator polls. It looks like it's more than just a swing, and Trump seems to be kind of floundering in his own response. His campaign has identified some of the key attack lines, like she's very liberal, etc., but he hasn't been able to stick to them. He's been rambling about crowd sizes, because that's what really gets him. So it's not clear he'll be able to come back on any message long enough he didn't think he was going to have to make an effort to win this time. It looked like Biden was doddering to defeat. And now Trump's faced with a really energised candidates and energised opposition party, Democratic Party, almost running on a change ticket. And he wasn't prepared for that. And he doesn't seem to be able to adjust.
Yeah, I think Tim Walz has made an appreciable difference. He's added a huge shot in the arm to the Kamala Harris campaign and given huge impetus. He's the kind of the plumber Joe type figure. He's very ordinary and he revels in his ordinariness. And there's a very good article in the Sunday Times that talks about him going in as an assistant coach to a small high school team in Michigan in the 1990s, and his inspiration and his generosity to the players turned them from kind of serial losers to winning the state championship. And Americans love that kind of, you know, get up and go. Yeah. kind of story.
I saw somebody saying that another one of his talents is that, like Joe Biden, he can make liberal policies seem like common sense. Yeah. So, you know, he's talking about stuff that's fairly divisive kind of stuff along the lines of, you know, Roe v. Wade and all this kind of stuff. Where I come from, we have a saying, mind your own business, like in classic.
But you see, he's made videos with his daughter and he kind of comes across as a very ordinary father. Yeah. Shows him going with her to a fun ride.
So, Lucinda, we were all convinced 3 weeks ago Trump has it won. Yeah. The photograph did it. Now everyone's decided slam dunk.
And even before the assassination attempt, I mean, Trump was way ahead in all of the swing states and looked unassailable, actually. And I think what's fascinating is how, as Oisin has alluded to, he just simply cannot cope with the change at the top of the Democratic ticket. He does not know how to respond or react to Kamala Harris. And it's not that necessarily she's an outstanding candidate. She's been an underwhelming VP, I think.
And not facing the media, not doing interviews.
Which I think she'll get. I think that won't actually hamper her too much at all. Because as we've been discussing, you know, media and communication
TikTok
changed.
Will do the
Everything
work
has
for
changed.
Her. Yeah.
But I think. But I mean, his reaction to her, his response, it has brought out all of his worst instincts, and he really is floundering at the moment. Whether he can claw it back, I think. You know, that's anybody's question. The US, like all electorates at the moment, is particularly volatile and things can change pretty rapidly. But at the moment, it looks like she certainly has stolen a big march on him.
Yeah.
She's creeping ahead.
She has the Congress, the convention, which will, give her another 3%.
He was fantasizing on his own social media platform that Biden might crash the convention and take the nomination back. So like he basically wants to run against Joe Biden.
I read a report of one private meeting or dinner or something with donors recently, and they were waiting to see, okay, so what's his pivot going to be and everything. He started ranting onto them about stop the steal, and they were like, oh my god, is this where we're at? Sinead, have you been watching all this?
Yeah, no, I just think I was chatting to some American friends during the week, including one African American woman, and just she was smiling, you know, just had that sense that there's energy, there's hope.
Joy seems to be.
That's the headline of The Observer. She's bringing the joy.
Yeah. And it's good to see he looks like the darkness.
Yeah, but it's good to see those words being used by politics in any country.
And I think their description of him as weird as well has really had resonance and has really kind of thrown him back. And he's upped the attacks on her. There was a great story in the New York Times about a speech he gave during the week in which he talked about a Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, and him being in a helicopter with him in the 1990s, which nearly crashed. And he said during that, Willie Brown said some nasty things about Kamala Harris, with whom he had a romantic liaison in the 1990s. The helicopter trip never happened. The near crash never happened. Donald Trump confused Willie Brown with another black politician from California, Nate Holden. And it happened in 1990.
See, already all the people on TikTok are going, blah, 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 detail, detail, detail. We heard the first bit and that's it, you know. That's it's unfortunately how it seems to be. Okay, we'll take a break. Lucinda Creighton, Harry McGee, Sinead McSweeney and Oisin Coughlan staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Lucinda Creighton, Harry McGee, Sinead McSweeney and Oisin Coughlan. Sinead, you picked an interesting piece in the Sunday World about Brendan Grace's wife. An interview with her. The pain of Brendan passing for me is still very much there. It doesn't go away. It's 5 years on from his death.
Yeah, I suppose it struck a chord with me because Brendan Grace died in the same 24 hours as my own husband, Noel.
Noel Whelan, known
in this parish.
Yeah.
They had both actually been at the Kennedy Summer School in New Ross the previous September.
Really?
So I had pictures of the two of them together. And next thing, these two giants were gone in the same 24 hours. But what really struck me was her description of the loneliness. You know, she says it's 5 years on, but it still hurts. And it does. And it's a loneliness that... it's a loneliness in crowds and in company, because that person that you could just exchange a glance with who'd know exactly what you were thinking isn't there. And I just thought she just captured that pain. And I know a lot of people who are also at that kind of 5 year mark and beyond. And it does still hurt. And it's good to see somebody saying it.
Yeah, it strikes some people, I think, now and again, when Noel Whelan's name comes up or something that you might connect in your head with him. what would Noel Whelan say about this now? It must strike you all the time, does it? Like this stuff that has happened in the last 5 years that he missed.
That he has missed, and what would he have thought of it? And if you think of this 12 months alone, I was actually have invited Simon Harris down to the next Kennedy Summer School, which is on at the end of the month. And one of the things I said to do the Noel Whelan interview, right? And I said to him, in this year of all years, with elections behind us, elections in front of us, like this would be, you know, a kind of a fitting tribute to Noel. He'd have been having a blast. I wouldn't have seen him from one end of the day to the other.
Yeah. Edna O'Brien got a fitting, extraordinary, poetic send-off yesterday too, didn't she?
Beautiful, and befitted her status as one of the great Irish novelists of the 20th and 21st century. One of the mourners, Valerie Hanley, in the Mail on Sunday, is one of several writers in the Sunday newspapers who write about it today. But the ceremony itself seemed to be extraordinary. It happened on an island in County Clare called High Island, which is near to Tuam Grainy, close to where she herself was born and reared. It was a Catholic mass, which is strange because much of her early career was about her very tempestuous relationship with the Catholic Church. She was censored. She was shunned during the 1960s. One of the mourners said perhaps she was a writer that was 35 years before her time. The recognition at home probably only came...
Cancelled, I think the word is.
She was cancelled in the 60s, especially. But she was prolific and she continued to write. She wrote different types of novels later in her career, but they were equally compelling. But
I spoke to her here after she wrote Girls, that book about Boko Haram kidnappings.
Yeah.
And she was coming up for 90 at that stage. She'd been out to Africa to suss out the whole scene out there and everything.
She researched like a journalist. So everything in all of her books was always factually accurate. Mm-hmm. She went for those, there was a book about Brendan O'Donnell in the 1990s.
Yeah.
She also wrote about Dominic
McGlinchey. Which at the time, again, a lot of people felt...
Too close to the bone, very controversial.
Which was an extraordinary book. The priest actually did seem to apologise for the church yesterday. He did say about how she was shunned and everything. And he said something along the lines of, and that was on us and that shouldn't have happened. I think he was talking about all of us in a way, but at the same time, I thought it was a nice kind of loop back around as... At the end of her life. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much to my excellent panel this morning, Lucinda Creighton, CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former Minister for European Affairs, Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times, Sinead McSweeney, former Global Head of Public Policy at Twitter and now psychology student at TCD, and Oisín Coughlan, Chief Executive Friends of the Earth Ireland.